Purpose and life meaningfulness are big, strong predictors. And again, looking at data of like hundreds of thousands of people, these are big N studies. All right, well, that's all interesting. But what does it mean sort of in the trenches? And what is purpose in people's everyday lives? I'm sure everyone feels either like they have some kind of a purpose or they have none. It's interesting. Everyone's totally one or the other. So I really wanted to get at what this was, what it is when it's not a survey. So I got the chance to collaborate with this giant company, 500,000 employees all around the world. And they had a really interesting question, which was, what is the thing that we're not measuring, which is the biggest predictor of productivity with inside the organization?
Welcome to the Enrichment Project, Path to Purpose, recorded by the mad talent at Solid Gold Podcast. It is a series of unfiltered and insightful conversations with some of the most remarkable purpose-driven human beings who have all achieved, created, inspired, triumphed, or challenged, and we have a great deal to learn from them. It is a quest to uncover and articulate the steps along the way to help you on your own journey of purpose. I am your host, Richard Wright, and I am delighted to have you with me. Thank you for the gift of your time. Let's dive straight in. You've listened to episode number one. If you haven't, stop straight away. Go and find episode one. This is episode two with the mad professional scientist. It's Vivian Ming. Vivian, it's really amazing to have you back. I'm super excited about what you've got in store for us this time because that first episode was just rad. So thank you for coming back.
Thank you for using language like rad that brings me back to my childhood.
Great. So we're actually going straight back to some of that, well, not quite childhood, but you told me off air just now, and listening in, this is going to date this episode, and that's quite okay. We're heading into the festive holiday season, and the question I asked Vivian was, are you taking a break? And Vivian, you just got to repeat that answer for me, please.
Breaks aren't really part of my makeup, which is to say, back in graduate school, my first year in grad school, I got kind of addicted to building neural networks, watching them learn while watching The Sopranos. And it turned out I was doing that on October 19th, which happens to be my birthday. And the entire graduate program had organized a birthday party, and I was in my lab in a completely different building. I completely forgot that my own birthday party was taking place. I never showed up for it, which I suspect made it a better party.
That's terrible.
That was an earlier life. And while by that point, anyone who listened to part one knows that all of the external parts of my life by then were going wonderfully well, I was not so thrilled with myself. Right. And so it's actually hard for me to imagine that a birthday party for me without me being there wouldn't have been a better experience for everyone else. But maybe that was just me coloring everything I saw.
And we do that. That's our bias, right? That's what we do. So what I quite like about that, and it's the reason why I wanted to bring it in, and I think it's a great place for us to kick off the conversation, is one of the threads about this path to purpose is the idea of researching your obsessions. What are the things that you're obsessed about, that you're passionate about? Because a lot of that is going to lead us to this idea of that brings me happiness, joy, makes me feel like I've got meaning, which essentially is the path to purpose. Well, so one of the questions I ask, and you've just answered it so well without realizing, is what are those things that you do where you know, at some point in time in the day, you're like, I don't think I've been to the bathroom today, or I really need to pee badly. Why is that? Or I skipped meals. When did I last have a meal? Or wasn't there a birthday party I was supposed to attend? And it is exactly that. Those things we get so engrossed because they feed our soul. Research those obsessions because they'll lead you somewhere. And then you said something else that was pretty cool after that, Vivian, about how you run your organization and leave and breaks.
Yeah. I mean, on to the last part, I'm a terrible manager. It doesn't mean I have no leadership skills, but my strengths definitely lie in other areas. I'm not here to manage other people's lives or their work. I have the laziest bone in the industry around that. I just want people to do something amazing. That's all. I'm a wonderful collaborator.
Yep.
And I'm right there with them in the trenches on the work being done, but them getting it done, I very much want to see people kind of rise up and do that. I realize they need help, which is why I hire grownups to handle that part for me, because I am not one. But in this particular case, we leave everything we do fairly open. And that means if you want to be working through the holidays, and my wife and I guarantee you, on December 25th, we will be sitting in our seats. I might be writing some code. She will probably be reviewing some research applications. That's what we enjoy doing.
Yeah.
I read science papers, I suspect the way other people read, you know, pop news articles.
Yeah.
Yes, it's engaging because, of course, for me, I actually am reading them for the why behind it. Like, I read through everything. What can I do with this? How does this play in? How does it change this grand story I'm telling myself? And, you know, the ones that really get me is like, how does this feed in to my next crazy science fiction adventure? And if my employees want to do that too, there's no enforced luau's at Sokos Labs. Yeah. That is not who we are. But the flip side is, you want a week off? I don't need a reason. You got a week off. You know, I'll let you know when it becomes problematic. I guess I use the same rule, an old one I heard a long time ago. If you want to loan money to friends, then loan the amount of money that you'd have simply given them. Because if they don't pay back, it doesn't matter. You'd have given them the money if they'd asked for it. If they do, that's wonderful too.
Yeah.
So I try to maintain that same relationship with all my employees. We're part of a little community here, a community which has made a choice to work on crazily hard problems for very little return. And in that sense, I'm going to trust that you're doing a good thing. And it doesn't always work out that way. And there are some hard conversations. But the simple truth is, I want people to do it, you know, for their why and their how. The rest of it actually doesn't matter that much to me. Yeah. So just go through and find your own way of getting it done. For me, it is very much, it's just who I am. It is synergy in the most honest sense, stripped of all the business lingo nonsense.
I really love that. And it's true, though, that when we empower people to be that and we trust them, we give them trust, they most often repay us with the same. When we distrust them and want to micromanage them, they repay us with the same. So, you know, interesting that you say that, because I'm looking at our holidays going forward and we're pretty much going to be at home. And I want to get stuck into writing this book. And people are saying, no, you need to take a break. I'm like, well, that is a break. You know, that for me, that is, I really love that. And I can do that and have, I don't have to worry about the emails because that's not happening. But that is my joy. So, you know, whatever that is for you, that's what it is. But the question I have on the back of that, Vivian, is, okay, so you said you're not a manager, you're a leader, and I think that you lead from the front and you lead by example, very much so. And you allow this freedom. How do you manage the expectation from an output point of view? What does that look like? How do people know how they are measuring up or what you're expecting? Because that's the measurement. It's not the time. It's not how you run your day. It's your output.
Yeah, you know, I guess part of what I have learned over the years is the kind of work that we do is, I guess you'd call it innovation-centered, invention-oriented. Mm-hmm. As I often say, I describe myself as a mad scientist. Half of it is if we knew it would work, it wouldn't be science. Mm-hmm. So for one thing, there are no hard deadlines because there can't be.
Okay. Right?
Someone comes to us and say, can you price the cost of our biased promotion decisions? Well, gosh, I don't know. No one's ever done that before. I'm certainly willing to try, But the idea that there's a timeline for making that happen is not realistic.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
And
actually,
while someone could approach it in a very engineering perspective, it's not kind of what I love, and it's not really what I do. So, you know, we're starting from this weird paradox of let's simultaneously assume everyone's presumptions about this problem are wrong, and that we don't know enough. We're not enough expert. So we need to read all about all of those previous assumptions.
Okay.
So yeah, that is a little paradoxical, but it means every problem starts with a super deep dive, trying to diagnose through history why we've ended up with the misconception that we have, on the assumption that if someone's asking me for help, it's because what people are currently trying doesn't work.
Exactly.
So why do that same thing again, but better or faster or more regimented? So we really find ourselves diving hard and deep into problems, in which case, in some cases, like with my son and diabetes, within a month, we have a solution.
Wow.
No one had ever built an AI for diabetes. And within a month, the first version of Jitterbug is ready to go. And literally last night, I'm writing code on an updated version now, whatever it is, 9 years later. So that's had a long life, getting better and better over time. The original version was sort of before deep neural networks, and we've advanced it. But bam, who would have thought that something no one had ever done before would be so easy? But flip over to the other side of what I'm working on. Some of my education work, for example, has been an incredibly long learning process. My first big project in that was my first company, which was launched in 2008. Well, it's 12 years later, and I feel like I'm still just figuring out what's really going on under the surface in education and what it actually takes to make a difference in that space. Some problems are quick, some are long. For my case, what I'm looking for is learning. Learning that has life in the world, that has an application, that I can now say definitively, because I put 3 months into this problem, something is tangibly different. Something that I could go and offer a talk on or give a briefing or build something around. So, you know, I have to be very adaptable. Everyone loves, when I get hired to come in and do a talk or a briefing, you know, we don't consult, but we've worked on an incredible diversity of problems. I'm always happy to come in for a day or two and just, you tell me what you're working on and I give you the context from our research.
Yeah.
It's always a pleasure. It's fun for me. Plus it helps fuel some of the actual philanthropic work we do.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of that is just simply telling people, okay, well, those three things you're doing don't work. Yeah. Like, it's like I'm a goalie. I'm just trying to keep bad policy out of the back of the net.
Yeah.
It's 90% of my visits to companies is around that. But that 10% is the end result of it all, is now finally we know here's the positive thing. And you just got to be very adaptable and take those small wins as they come along.
Yeah. Oh, what's interesting about the goalie concept is that actually what you're doing is preventing own goals. You're preventing your own team from scoring against you is what you're really doing.
That's true.
Because that's what they are, their own goals, right? I love that concept. And it's that radical departure. And that quote, Orrin Hirari, the electric light bulb did not come about from continuous improvement or candles. That at some point in time, some bright spark said, we need a radical departure from this way of thinking, because we can innovate the candle until the cows come home. It's still a candle. But it's quite hard to do that, because we do tend to be wired a certain way, and we do tend to keep on rethinking the same things in the same way. And I love the fact that so much of your research and so much of what you do is trying to change that. So I think this is a great time to bring in that thread that you put out on social media today, talking about executives and the idea of righteous choices and right now choices. Can you please explain that to us a little bit? Because that's exactly it, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, I guess it was the end of 2019.
Right.
Just about the same time, I guess, a little earlier, I was invited to give the keynote for the Grace Hopper Conference. So this is the largest Women in Computing, Women in Technology conference in the world. And I had never been before because I'm just not a conference goer by instinct. If I'm not on the stage, then I'm not
You're not going to go. Right.
But they asked me to do the closing keynote. And it was actually the year before they'd asked me to do a keynote and I couldn't. And so they asked for a quote and then they sent me a picture. My line was on the wall with like a quote from Malala and all these famous women in history. And I just thought, well, that was some unearned glory, but that's wonderful. But I had said, if ambitious men have been promising us self-driving cars and spaceships super intelligent AI, if every little girl had been given the reins to her own potential, we'd already have them. And I didn't mean it, you know, as some little men suck, women are awesome. I just mean we've tied one of our arms behind our back. There's half the population is just as amazing. And forget, of course, just little girls. What about every little kid that didn't have the chance to become who they truly could have been? Where would the world be if only they'd had that opportunity? If they had been working on the next light bulb or coronavirus cure or what have you. So I sent that and I got that feedback. So when they asked me the following year, actually they booked me that same day, like, all right, let's make certain you're free. Can you come out? And I said, absolutely. Such an honor. I get to give a talk to 30,000 people, like far and away. I've done some big crowds, but nothing like that. It's like giving a talk to the weather. There's like a scattered squall of laughter that rolls across the room.
Oh, amazing.
So I was very honored. But then in prep, they say, so we want you to give a talk about courage. Like our whole theme for the year is going to be about overcoming fear. And I was really upset because I don't have any research about courage. I've never done any research that I thought of as having direct contact with that idea. So why are they asking me, an expert on something, to come in and talk about something else? And I would pompously call myself an expert on a lot of things. And they picked like one thing that I don't do.
I'm not it.
Yeah. And so I was actually a little grumpy about it. And I thought, well, okay, first off, they had everyone giving a talk had to come with a tagline. We will be. And they were all, you know, we will be strong and we will be united. And so I said, just to give them a big F you for making me talk about courage. Mine was, we will be scared. So in the keynote closing talk about courage, the first thing that flashes up on the screen is we will be scared. But of course you are. I mean, I've been scared so many times in my life. And besides, what does it do? What way does it help people to say, be courageous? There's a switch and I didn't, I've had this uncowardly the whole time. I didn't appreciate how important that was. Thank you for cluing me in. It hadn't occurred to me to be courageous. So all I could do is really reflect. An anecdote about a colleague of mine who died of pancreatic cancer and how, you know, we were talking earlier about working through the holidays. She was working through dying. She hadn't quite gotten tenure. She's an education researcher. She borrowed these gloves from me, it could be used on a touchscreen.
Okay.
Because she would be all wrapped up in blankets, but she still wasn't warm enough. She's just cadaverous and cold all the time. She borrowed them so she could keep working. She worked, as far as I know, essentially up to the day she died, with her two little girls. Okay, I can't go too deep because I'll start crying. But she got tenure like a month before she passed away. Everyone knew she was going to. So it was a little bit of an honorific. But what I shared was, this is what mattered to her. It mattered to her so much that she wanted to show her daughters that this counted more, that this is what part of what her life was about was them and her research. And so she pushed through all of this. So I shared that story because, I mean, what kind of courage does that take? All right, I'm choking up a little bit. So then I got to cut away to some research we've done, some that we've talked about purpose, because obviously it felt like in that story, part of where she got her courage to push through this disease was that she had a purpose.
Sounds like
and
that,
it fit all those definitions. It was bigger than her. Mm-hmm. It was going to definitionally take more than her lifetime to complete, but she did it anyways. So I went through some of my purpose research, and then I talked about some other work that I've done. And what's interesting is it hadn't occurred to me while I was giving that talk, because like all of my talks is just bullshit that I made up in the middle of the, I'm out up on stage and someone comes off afterwards and said, God, that was so good. You know, I didn't see your slides anywhere. I said, slides? I made that up as I was going. It just felt right in the moment. So I like to give producers heart attacks. That is my purpose as a speaker, is to make A-type producers really keel over. And I went on and talked about some other research I had done. But one thing that I hadn't occurred to me at the time, and I've had the chance to do this a few times since, is I've been a part of this wargaming, sort of a corporate wargaming exercise. I was not the organizer, but I was brought in for a few years in a row to be part of this particular exercise, which is, I will describe as being about courageous decision making.
Right.
Which is to say, you put them in a scenario in which they have to make a set of choices. And in almost all of those scenarios, when people first see the choices, they're like, this is absurd. I mean,
it's a no-brainer.
There's A and B. To be B, you have to be like a supervillain. You know, you'd have to be the Joker to want to do B. A is so obviously the right thing to do. Would you, you know, I use this example in my tweet just because it sort of catches the moment.
Yeah.
Right now, all of these companies all around the world, but it certainly is happening a lot in America, are faced with a choice of taking a bunch of idle workers and either laying them off or furloughing them. At least in the latter case, they still have healthcare in the US system, but they're not getting a paycheck. Or, as I propose and others have as well, what if you actually paid them to learn? Mm. Paid them to take this time where they're not doing anything, where you are getting money, right? We had this big government program, at least for smaller businesses, to pump money into smaller businesses to keep paying their employees.
Yeah.
And yet so many companies complained, please let me do something else with it. I don't have anything for my employees to do. Let me keep the money and fire my employees, please. Wow. So many hotels, for example, said things like that. And I just thought, what a condemnation of humanity. Like, really, you can't think of anything for your employees to do when you can pay them.
Yeah. So you pay them.
I was truly stunned.
And they become better. Which means that by the time you open your doors,
they could become better.
Yeah. And you're going to make more money and be more profitable when you open your doors again. It's like, where's the bad? Where's the downside?
That is my dream. And I know people's fear, because I know this space well. The fear is, we're going to invest all this money in making them better and they'll go someplace else.
Right.
In which case, I think, God, pay it forward.
Yeah. Well done.
You know, please do something worthwhile. We ran this thing, and what we found over and over again is people's gut reaction. And then when you run the scenario, they always make this sort of better choice. Mm. And then you put stakes in. Mm. And sometimes it can be financial stakes. Sometimes it can be actual career stakes. But it turns out all you need is reputational stakes. You just frame it. You know, you are... I think everyone has this idea of what a consultant is. So you come in and you are a consultant. You're going to advise this company on what they should do. And when you come up with your plan, you're going to describe it to everyone else in the room who, like you, is a senior business executive who's also role-playing a consultant. They know whether you're bullshitting or not. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, virtually everyone goes from, well, it's obvious, you pay people who are idle to actually learn and train. Everyone switches over to lay them all off. In fact, it might be a wonderful opportunity to reduce, an unnecessary employee load and retool for the future.
The deadwood. Yeah.
So, like, in an instant. And it wasn't just that one. We ran literally dozens and dozens of scenarios, hundreds and hundreds of senior executives. And let me be clear before anyone has a mistake here.
Yeah.
I have every reason to believe everyone would make similar decisions on some level, with an exception, which is in fact where we're headed. But hundreds of people across dozens and dozens of scenarios, they all choose right, or they all choose righteous. They all choose the thing, the idealized thing that we immediately go with when there are no stakes. And as soon as there are stakes, particularly reputational stakes, suddenly it's the right now answer. It's the thing that proves to you, to everyone around you, that you understood the problem and you're going to make the tough choice. It feels right. But the truth is, the problem is your interests and the interests of something bigger.
Yeah.
Right? That is what I feel like a courageous decision is. That's kind of what I, in prepping for this talk, what I came to really decide was a moment of fear and a moment of courage are those moments when what the world truly needs and what you want in the moment diverge. And if your interests are so wrapped up in these decisions, I guarantee you, you will make the right now choice. Yeah. You will pick that easy path that satisfies your needs, not because you're a villain, not because you're a bad person. One, it's just because you're human. Mm. And two, because we put an enormous amount of effort in wrapping up our self-interest with the choices that are in front of us. And that's where it becomes really hard, where it feels like it's the right decision. But it only feels that way when your personal stakes are on the line. Mm-hmm. So, all right, that's great. I'm saying people can be cowardly some of the time. And again, just like with the statement about courage, so you have a switch. How do you magically change this? Mm-hmm. It turns out it's anything but magic. You can't. What I think we kind of explored in our last conversation that went through some aspects of my life, but it turns out it's very much supported by a lot of research, is the way you become courageous. Like, you're not born with it. I'm not saying there's no difference between people and maybe genes play a bit of a role, but fundamentally, starting from your childhood, the way you build courage is through practice. This is something you have to engage in. If you've waited your whole life until that moment where the world really needed you to actually confront a courageous choice, you're not going to make the one you thought you were going to. You're going to go right along with everyone else. You're going to pick right now over righteous. But it turns out, if you practice along the way, and practice means explicitly, not, you'll find little things in your life, things where, you know, who cares if I do this right now? It's not really going to hurt anyone. I know it isn't really the best thing to do, but I'm going to help and it's not really going to hurt. Start small. Make those choices. Practice what it feels like. Because if you haven't practiced, you will not be ready when the time comes. And the simple truth is, you probably won't even feel it. It'll feel like the right choice because you're so wrapped up in this idea that the world is a terrifying place and there's a very narrow path to go through it. And it turns out there isn't. There's an enormous path, enormous set of choices that people can make. But most of them are hidden by this fear. You need to practice hard to break through that early on. And so I guess it ended with this line, which is, you know, courage isn't something you are, it's something you practice. And it actually, I dovetailed it with something I've often said in the education space, which is, be the person you want your kids to be. That's probably my best answer to being a parent, because of the copious research about our impact as role models on our children. Be the person you want them to be. That's the biggest impact you'll ever have on them, is what they see you do. So if you want to get started, start making those simple little choices at home that your kids might see you make, so that it gets passed along to them. They actually get the practice for free right from the beginning. Yeah. Not saying it's easy. That's the whole point. This takes time. It takes effort. And we will be scared.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That just brings in so many elements of what I'm trying to do with this project. And what I've always said about kids is that, number one, our job as parents is to create this platform where our kids can become better human beings than we ever could, but we've got to become that first for them. And then how do you change the world? Well, you change the world by becoming that person for your children. You know, it starts with your children. That's how you change the world. And then the last thing is that the last step in terms of the path to purpose is the T, and that is tackle your fears. And every single purpose comes with that. And what's quite interesting is that just today, I put something out about the year that I've had through COVID, and it's been one of my most successful years ever. And it's all been about how can I help you? It's been really phenomenal. And somebody commented back and said to me, you know what, Richard, everybody that I know that is wired the same way as you has made a success out of 2020. And my comment was, no, I'm not wired any differently. You know, that wiring is exactly what you're talking about. It is when you're confronted with things, you practice and you practice and you practice and you put yourself in that place and you keep on practicing and keep on practicing. And it's like any other muscle in your body. It's that thing that you need to keep on working on. And even then, when you think you've got it and sorted, if you don't keep on working it, you're going to lose it again. And that really is what it is. And what you're talking about right now is that whole amazing concept of neuroplasticity and being able to rewire our brains to think differently. But it is hard work, which is why so few people do it. You've made it this far, probably because the topic resonated with you. If you're wondering what the show is all about, listen to the trailer at the start of the season and find out how this show is going to help you along your own path to purpose. You've stumbled on a project that is all about purpose. Find out why the guests are all so vastly different, but yet all have so much in common. Hop on board this journey with me, follow the Enrichment Project so that you don't miss out on a single episode, and share it with, well, everyone. We are all looking for more meaning in our lives. If the show speaks to your identity or the identity of your brand, consider sponsoring a season. Let's make the circle bigger. Back to the episode, and thanks for listening.
It is tremendously hard work, and I most certainly, although I've stared away from the language, I most certainly think about this from the perspective of a neuroscientist, yeah, with some economic and behavioral economic modeling tackled in. So, yeah, you know, I'm talking about things like subjective utility. I'm thinking about the reward system from the dopaminergic system writ large, all the way down to specific endogenous opioid signaling in the brain. I mean, there's so many things going on at a low level inside your brain, but what it really comes down to is the parts of you that tend to dominate your decision-making long run are parts of you that learn slowly. Mm. They learn by lots of rich examples. It takes lived experience to shift these parts of your brain around. We love to believe that we are incredibly rational. And we have that capability, absolutely. Yeah. But as I often describe to people, our whole identity is a giant, messy democracy. I mean, it makes the American system look like engineered precision by comparison.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you didn't even get to see all the votes.
Yeah.
You know, the ones you see are the ones, these sort of hyperactive parts of your neocortex, but there are votes coming in from lower parts of your brain. There are votes from deeper medial prefrontal parts that are really not terribly accessible to you. Why you're doing what you're doing tends to be more like stories after the fact. It's like you have, you know, a media and branding team coming up with good explanations for what were essentially totally random decisions that came down the pipeline, except that they're not random. They're built slowly over time. I'm not saying we shouldn't consider hard, you know, explicit learning and really running through. I'm a scientist. That's what science is supposed to be about.
For sure.
But the whole point of science, the whole thing, which is prove yourself wrong, is born out of the recognition that we are fundamentally imperfect as rational beings. Mm. So you got two choices. Come up with a highly rigid system for moving forward in a rational way. Mm-hmm. But the other is put the time into building that irrational component of yourself. I would argue, of course, as a Bayesian neuroscientist that it's actually rational in its own way. But for anyone who didn't understand the words I just used, it's not worth going into deeper, except to say the optimality of our brains is astonishing. It yeah. is such an amazing system. You know, you probably have heard of like medical school disease where, you know, medical students like learn about these incredibly exotic rare diseases and immediately think they've got it.
They've got it, yes.
So if you get a degree in neuroscience, you kind of have your version of that as well. You learn about all of these phenomenally rare but horrific disorders. And you think, maybe not that you've got it, but you realize it's astonishing. We should just fall down flat dead all of the time. None of this stuff should work. It's no wonder AI turns out to be so difficult. Our brains are astonishingly complex. Yeah. And but it comes after you've done this for a little while and you get past those initial fears, then you end up with a realization that you have to treat it with due complexity. My mantra about the brain is however complex you think it is, it's more complex than that. So if you think that there's a shortcut, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to find a little video of, you know, someone, you know, really gutting it up and working hard. I'll post it on LinkedIn with the line, you know, strength is good business or some nonsense like this. And as though it's that simple.
Yeah.
You know, you could just be a person that pushes through tragedy at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
When instead, it's actually often quite the opposite. It's tragedy that really transforms a person, that goes through that process that we are otherwise unwilling to engage in. But let me tell you, someone that's been through tragedy, and I think you can say this as well, don't opt for that as your solution. No. That's not fun. it's not that this is, don't, I jokingly say this, you have experienced it. We shouldn't think of, you know, sort of optional brain surgery as a solution to our problems.
Yeah.
Turns out it's a really brutal experience going in for surgery. Instead, how do you actually take the systems that we were born with, our amazing brain, our amazing body, however imperfect it may be, and really go through the hard work of training it?
Yeah.
So my feelings about this are informed by neuroscience and they're informed by machine learning and massive data sets. But I, you know, the funny part is, I guess I arrive at, in some ways, a lot of traditional thinking, but for the fact that I think so much of that traditional thinking gets wrapped up in a kind of branded nonsense, that obfuscates the actual hard work it takes to get there. If you're not willing to put the hard work in, it's not going to change. Again, hundreds of some of the smartest, hardest working people I know, literally every single one of them failed to be the person that they thought they would be when their own career was on the line.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. And there's so many questions I have, and we've got so little time. I would love to, I mean, imagine just climbing in your brain, but I think I would just fry my own brain by doing that. So I'm far more simplistic in my own take. And I'm not a neuroscientist, like not even the first little rung on the ladder. So I like to try and explain it with people, you know, in terms of how to get better performance or how to from a willpower point of view and from a self-discipline point of view and being better and getting better and saying that our brain is pretty much two halves and it's a thinking brain and a feeling brain. And I think we like to think we're rational human beings and think that the thinking brain is in charge, and it so isn't in charge. It's all about that feeling brain. And that's very often the stuff that we don't think, it's the subconscious. So that's how I look at it. But from my point of view, from the brain surgery and getting through some pretty epic big things, despite going through all these things that people told me shouldn't be possible. And I think for me, it was years and years and years of practice as an endurance athlete. I used to cycle for hours and hours on my own, a lot of training on my own, and pushing through the hard bits where you hypoglycemic, you've checked out a long time ago, and you're 2 hours from home. And it's that repetitive. So in so many ways, my own neurosurgeon said, you know, if I could pick one person who's most likely to overcome this, it would probably be you, although you're probably the last person I would ever have thought was going to get this in the first place. And it really is, it's that skill. But for me, my entire battle, my whole life, and that's my first book is all about that, is the having to unbecome and do the hard emotional work. So that's been harder for me. The brain stuff, the thinking brain, that has been easier than the unbecoming of the emotional stuff, which is what underpins all of that other stuff anyway. What's your take on that?
You know, there was a paper that came out just this year, I believe. I'd have to dig it up to confirm for certain, but it had this really interesting finding. And it may at first sound like we're talking about a different thing, but I'll extend it out. Yeah. They were looking at honesty. And they were looking at brain patterns, brain activation patterns, while people were lying or being honest about things. So there's a whole kind of rich psychological and neural literature on this domain. And it turns out there's cool and terrifying things. I work in this space of neuroprosthetics and cyborgs, if you will. And one of the more terrifying findings in that space is there is a part of your brain I can stimulate, which will cause you to be more honest. Which is interesting, very interesting. So, but if you run an experiment and you look at connectivity patterns, so this is a big new space, relatively speaking, in neuroscience, are these large-scale network connections. Mm-hmm. And one of the most pronounced ones, important for a lot of what we're talking about right now, is this connective network between your prefrontal cortex, particularly like medial prefrontal, and your amygdala. So if the audience has heard about the amygdala, they probably heard about it in terms of fear. Like this is the fear center of your brain, but it's involved in all sorts of complex things. And this is actually part of a broader network in general. So why is this interesting? It turns out if I take someone who sort of by default is honest, a group of people, and then another group of people who kind of by default are a little skeevy.
Shady.
You know, they're kind of reflexively try to hide things. What is interesting is their brain patterns are the complete opposite.
Wow.
For the honest group to lie, the prefrontal area, this area that's more about an explicit control, a decision. Yeah. It's you making a more of a choice. Turns on, becomes more active, and essentially, this is vastly oversimplifying, but essentially overrides your amygdala, overrides the default of honesty. If they want to lie, they have to explicitly make the effort. It is an effortful action for them.
Yes.
Whereas for this other group, it was the exact opposite. The effortful action was telling the truth. Greater prefrontal activity, stronger connectivity. So there are other complexities involved in this story, but essentially you get at why were you successful? Why were you the right person for this terrible disease? Because your default was to keep going. And almost certainly there are some aspects of your genetic makeup and some aspects of your epigenetics that were there. But this was also part of the very nature of training, right? I'm imagining, I'm telling you when you would know better than I, but I'm willing to bet a lot of training, particularly for endurance athletes, is less about training the body and more about training the mind. It's about keeping going exactly when you say you're 2 hours from home and you're done. There's nothing left, but you have to keep going. So I'm willing to bet the equivalent of that frontal amygdala story is that your frontal lobe actually has to activate, make an explicit choice to give up. You have trained the basic architecture of your brain. Your reflexive choice, if you will, is to keep going. We might call it your default network is the one that doesn't give up. And it is only through an explicit choice that you would. That's kind of what I'm getting at. What's going on in that default network? Because if you have to make an effortful, exhausting choice to be the person you wish you were over and over again, it's not going to work. You just can't sustain it through a life. Maybe a good metaphor here, because I don't know that it's terribly a metaphor at all, is, imagine being an addict. Mm-hmm. Pick your addiction, but imagine being an addict and essentially confronting yourself like it's right there on the table in front of you every day. and you have to resist it versus the actual process that really works, which is starting slow. A lot of cognitive behavioral therapy has been a solid approach here, though not all by itself. Starting slow, starting with situations where you have a lot of control, and moving towards those really challenging moments. Yeah. You wouldn't just immediately throw yourself in the deep end of addiction. The moment you get out of cleanup, suddenly you're right back in the same place. The people that do fail, bam, just like that. You need to slowly build yourself into that other person. I think we're looking at the same thing here. And the world's unfair. Some people are going to have biological advantages here, but everyone can change. And you just have to be willing. And if it helps you at all, imagine you have that little contest and we want to flip it from you having to make that effortful frontal decision.
Yeah.
Always, every time. What it's going to do is slowly train the rest of your brain, train it out so that it makes it easier. I'm vastly oversimplifying here, but this is how I think about this problem.
Yeah. So you're 100% correct about any kind of training. I would say that an Ironman isn't three events or three disciplines, the swim, the cycle, and the run. It's actually four. It's a continuous brain exercise the whole way. And it's this argument between how the body's feeling and what the brain wants. And there again is the purpose. And for me, it's how important those finish lines are, what that means to me, especially fighting brain cancer at the same time, getting there, what that means. And saying to myself, if I can do that, if I can get to that finish line, I can beat brain cancer. You know, it's that hard. And then there's a switch. There's a lot of research that's been done about this, and I'm sure you'll know in terms of the overriding the switch in your brain, which is that self-protective mechanism that says you're tired before you're tired, because your brain's saying, okay, hold on 2 seconds. We need to, our job is to protect. And learning as an endurance athlete to keep on overriding that and push the limits of that and how much you can. But I'd like to switch away because there's some really great questions I'd still like to ask you. But this one we need to, because it's part of the purpose why we are here. And that is to talk about the research that you've done, the maths, applying maths to purpose and sacrifice within organizations. And this is something that fascinates me and something that I would love to be more instrumental in helping organizations to achieve. So I'm hoping that you can help me as much as everybody else.
I would love that. So the very first part of the story I'm going to go through super quickly, not because it's not relevant or interesting, but I think we want to get to the deep purpose, and I tend to give long answers. So I come out of being an academic, I start a couple of education companies, and then I get poached from one of my own startups to become the chief scientist of what turns out to be one of the first companies doing artificial intelligence in hiring. Specifically sourcing, which is going out and finding people to bring in for an interview. So we built this huge database, 122 million people. We're looking for all the things, not that predict whether you get hired. That's easy. What's your name, your school, and your last job? Literally, it's that easy to understand whether someone will hire you.
Yeah.
What predicts the quality of work that people will do? And what we found was all the traditional things that recruiters rely on, just not useful. It's not to say going to a good university or having worked at a great company before isn't a predictor, but generally what we find is that simply you went to that university, you got hired for the same reason that I now want to hire you. You're not better because you went there. Mm. It's just another signal that you have these deeper qualities. So what are these deeper qualities? Turns out we ended up tracking, and now still at Socos Labs, about 50 different constructs. It's not like it's a theory of intelligence. It's just, what are the things that are really predictive? Turns out not only of quality of work on the job, but life outcomes. What predicts health outcomes, wealth outcomes, happiness, social connectedness? It's about you. It's about the things that are very much you. It's not a skill set. It's not your social connections, although there's an aspect to it. I'm going to give you the very roughest. It is very much in that space. So it obviously helps to know how to do a thing. I'm not against that. I'm just saying it doesn't do any good to have amazing math skills or to be really knowledgeable about programming or whatever it might be if you don't have these deeper qualities. Mm-hmm. And roughly speaking, just an overview. Cognitive skills, social skills, emotional intelligence, creativity-related skills, and metacognition, which is kind of about self-management, a little more explicit than the others. So 50 constructs across these five very broad, rough categories. Mm-hmm. And what do they all have in common? They are, one, measurable. Now, we're going to talk about purpose. So one of the things I'm claiming is purpose is measurable, and I'll get into that in a moment. Two, they are highly correlated with, and in many cases, provably causally related to positive life outcomes. In other words, having these qualities, and more importantly, changing it about yourself, changes life outcomes, ideally, for the better. And number three, and to me, this is the most important, they are changeable. Mm-hmm. There are things that are very predictive of people's life outcomes, like the postal code you grew up in. But I can't, after the fact, change that about you. That's just the truth of your childhood.
It is what it is.
Maybe it's a social justice story that we can all take much more seriously than we do, but we can't magically change your life story in that way. Mm. So there are things that are predictive that we don't have control over. And another is genetics, except it turns out even genetics is a vastly more complex story than we would like to tell ourselves. It's all genes, or it's all environment, or it's even a mixture of the two. Boy, it is connectomics and epigenetics. It is development and circumstance and so many other things. Like I said, we are all an incredibly messy, irrational democracy. Mm. But one of those constructs that we discovered, there are a couple that I kind of think of as, oh God, I can't say this anymore, Trump constructs. All right, I got to come up with a new word for this now. But it used to be Trump powers, like the superheroes that had like super speed or mind control. They were Trump powers because you could beat anybody else. Not anymore. But there were a few of these, like working memory is one about general cognitive ability that I research a lot, and it has a big component in people's lives, even COVID-19, it turns out. But one of these was purpose. We'd find it again and again as a really emergent thing. How is purpose defined? How is it measured? Mm-hmm. So we talked about some of these definitions before, but purpose in the psychological literature, it's construct strength of purpose. May not be exactly how people think of it in the everyday, mm-hmm. but it is something that is bigger than you, something that would take more than a lifetime to complete. And it is usually measured in psychology via a survey. So we give you a questionnaire that surveys a bunch of highly validated questions. So people put a lot of effort to go through and see if this pattern of answers, does it tie into this conceptual definition, and does it relate? And sure enough, if you take the survey, even a self-assessment, it turns out people's answers to those questions are strongly correlated with a whole bunch of very positive life outcomes. How fast you walk when you're age 65, how much money you have, how far you went in your education. Purpose and life meaningfulness are big, strong predictors. And again, looking at data of like hundreds of thousands of people, these are big N studies. All right, well, that's all interesting. But what does it mean sort of in the trenches? And what is purpose in people's everyday lives?
For sure.
I'm sure everyone feels either like they have some kind of a purpose or they have none. It's interesting. Everyone's totally one or the other.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to get at what this was, what it is when it's not a survey. So I got the chance to collaborate with this giant company, 500,000 employees all around the world.
Oh.
And they had a really interesting question, which was, what is the thing that we're measuring that we're not measuring, which is the biggest predictor of productivity with inside the organization? Now, I get to have super nerdy fun coming up with an algorithm that mashes up gradient descent, which is an optimization algorithm used in deep neural networks, right? A company like a deep neural network is a whole bunch of little independent units that are connected together. They get information in, they process it, and they put information out, and then there's a global outcome. Mm-hmm. Well, kind of sounds like a company. Got a whole bunch of employees. Mm-hmm. Each of them take information in, they do something with it, they put information out, and there's a global outcome. We literally took the math from deep neural networks and applied it to people, mashed up with something called value-added modeling from economic theory. So we put all this together, and then we looked. So that's fine, but what are the local behavior? And in a deep neural network, I can literally define what that local behavior is. So here we had to track people using, everyone knows about this now, contact tracing.
Yeah.
So
oh, for
contact
sure.
tracing, via phones is now everyone knows about it from COVID-19, but actually I've used it originally way back doing my education research. What do kids like? What do they talk about when the adults aren't around, when nobody else is listening? Do they speak the same? Does their language change? What if they're in a multilingual environment? What language do they prefer? So fascinating. I loved doing that research. So we got to take that and put it inside this company. What is the actual social network of this company? Mm-hmm. And what when that social network is embedded, two people may not work together at all, but they always get together for lunch. And we find person A and person B get together for lunch, and then person A and person C and person A and person D. And then this interesting thing happens. Whenever person A has lunch with someone, the other person, whoever they are, their team is more productive. Mm. And yes, we could see that begin to happen in our data. So what is the most consistently unmeasured in traditional work KPI terms? Mm-hmm. What is the most traditionally unmeasured source of productivity within organizations? Well, let me shorthand a whole lot of compilation of the data. Mm-hmm. It's sacrifice. It was when people took actions for which they would never receive a direct benefit. When people went out and had lunch and someone gave them a problem and they said, you know what, here's how I'd solve that. Or here's how I'd deal with that relationship issue. They meet at a conference, again, maybe even different companies. In some cases, we got to expand this research and saw that happening. Mm-hmm. But in general, there's actually a name for this in certain contexts. They call it collaborative leadership. Mm-hmm. As opposed to hierarchical, where you tell other people what to do. Here, the point of collaborative leadership is make everyone around you better. That is the way in which you are a leader. Mm. Except the thing is, no one gets really promoted for collaborative leadership. I mean, I think we pay it a lot of good lip service, but it's the hierarchical leaders, the noisy people in the room. Mm. If they can actually pair that with some success, they're the ones that get promoted. That's pretty clear. And again, in a hard number sense, it's very clear. But it's actually sacrifice. Well, I'm sure everyone knows where I'm going to go with this. What is the biggest correlate of those purpose surveys and all the behaviors people engaged in that we measured? It was sacrifice. People that made sacrifices. Mm-hmm. I don't mean they threw themselves on the grenade to save their coworkers. That doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah.
The way we put it is small sacrifices.
Yeah.
Still irrational, but people who made small sacrifices actually were bigger drivers of productivity throughout the organization. Pair that with the research I already told you, which is purpose-driven people tend to live longer, so their individual lives are better. Then in a company of 500,000 people, their actions drove greater productivity, even though, of course, they weren't getting promotions based on those actions. Mm. And there's up the paradox, which I often put this way. It's as though the story I'm telling you is that we're all in a giant race and that the people who win the race are the ones that stop and help the other racers. That it shouldn't work. You know, that doesn't make any sense. Not in like traditional liberal economic theory. We should all be rationally self-interested, you know, slightly assholes. But not mean about it. But turns out that's not the way that it works in the real world. There's a whole bunch of reasons I suspect that this is true. Yeah. I'm trying to get that macroeconomic element worked out because I'm writing a book called Small Sacrifices about all of this slowly over time. It's like number 5 in a series of books that are slowly coming in, lined up for a landing. But all the research, all of that initial research, purpose gives individual people better lives. Purpose, and this needs some explication, makes companies more productive. Mm. So why is it, when you look globally around the world, why does this have this positive transformative effect when economic theory tells us that it shouldn't, that it should be suboptimal? So the answer to that last question shouldn't drive how we make our individual decisions, should be enough to just say, hey, I want a better life. I want to be purpose-driven. But now we're back with courage, which is understand again what I'm saying. You've been lined up for a race.
Yeah.
You need to get to the end before everyone else does. And now I'm telling you to stop and help the other races. How many people would have the courage to do something so absurd? It sounds crazy. And I just told you, if you do it, you won't get that promotion. Not for those actions.
Sure.
So how much courage does it take to do something that you believe is right, something you're willing to make a sacrifice for, but actually to do it reflexively? Like, this is, I will do this no matter what. I know it won't help my career. I know it's not going to change anything about my life. I'm going to do it because it's the right thing. And here's, again, the real paradox of courage. If you did those things for yourself, you know, wink, wink, yes, I'm helping other people, but really, turns out it doesn't help.
Yeah.
It turns out as soon as the reason you're doing this moves away from the definition of a purpose, mm-hmm. it doesn't reap those benefits anymore. So, you know, how do you build up the courage to do the right thing when the right thing is so counter to what the right now is telling you?
That's a very, very, very big question. I'd love to turn that around, right? And in terms of what you're doing, so a lot of what you're doing, it has to serve you because you are getting better at what you do. The research that you're doing serves your thinking, which you apply to further thinking. You're helping a lot of other people along the race. You're making some massive sacrifices. One of them is a salary, an annual salary. You are doing a lot of work that is philanthropic. It's still benefiting you, right?
Obviously, I fundamentally believe that in doing the things, those other things, those bigger things I believe in,
yeah,
that those are the right choices for me. I'm not tied in to what those outcomes are. One of the interesting things about it, and another point of courage, is recognizing that means you don't really get tight control of what those outcomes look like. But the amazing thing is that they keep happening. You know, I sometimes call them gifts in the sense that not because I'm a spiritual person and I think that some entity is actually granting me the gifts for being a good person. No, mm-hmm. not at all. Mm-hmm. But rather I simply mean they're gifts in the sense that they're just unpredictable. They come out of nowhere. And yet they keep happening, you know, every year. My life gets better, even though I'm seemingly making these perverse choices. And yes, there are clearly moments where in very targeted ways, money being the most obvious, I think I would have made a terrible chief scientist at Uber, and I would have been very unhappy being there. Yeah. But I'm also well aware that having walked away from that job, I think I actually worked out the numbers at one point. Once they went through an IPO, I took like $10 million out of my pocket.
Yeah.
But that wasn't why I did what I did. Mm. That I was never going to achieve the things that I actually cared about, helping to optimize a system that I don't really believe in. Mm. Yes, I would have gotten rich, but I would have been very unhappy. And that may seem like a trade-off people are willing to make. Well, I'm going to be unhappy for a couple of years and I will achieve those riches. Except I think you'll find that if you don't look at those people that come out the other end, you look at everyone going in on the funnel. And that's the part that I think a lot of people miss.
Yeah.
Is one of my favorite blog posts of all time, and I'll never be able to redig it out again. But it started with, here is the ingredient for that entrepreneurial success, that IPO that we all dream of someday. And that starts by profiling, you know, Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, all of these sort of wunderkin, Harvard dropout types that mm-hmm. were gritty and founded the business. And it does like five or six profiles like that. And then it gives dozens and dozens of profiles of people that were exactly the same.
So,
they were just as genius.
Yeah.
They dropped out of Harvard or Stanford. They founded a revolutionary tech company and their lives took nothing like that same trajectory. If you really want to understand a problem, you have to understand the whole problem. Mm. Are there people that have made highly questionable choices that have kind of won life's lottery? Absolutely. Mm. But it turns out if what I look at are the averages and the medians, or in fact, even just the averages of the people that have ended up in the top 1% by whatever metric you want.
Yeah.
It is actually those people that made sacrifices. That is what drove those sorts of outcomes. And again, I don't mean they're Gandhi-esque sacrifices. What I mean is simply that there were times when right now beckoned, and they chose something that was more important. And in the long term, those choices pay off in people's lives in a way that right now, rather systematically, never does.
So immediately, and I'm listening to you, and I'm fascinated, and I'm really drawn into trying to understand this and how it impacts on my own life. And I even look at the project, that the reason why you were here, and that is to put together a book and then a course that can help people to find more meaning and to live out more of their purpose, which I think is a great thing. But then I'm thinking, okay, well, it can't be such a good thing, because what is your sacrifice, Richard? And then I go back to how I started this journey of professional speaking and thinking, okay, I gave up a really great salary and a profit share in a fabulous company. And I gave that all up to start from scratch. But then I've got a lot out of speaking on a stage. I'm a Leo. We love the limelight and the attention, and there is the ego at play here. But then there's also the other part that's I'm trying to enrich people's lives and help them to try and change how they think in a way that's going to impact their futures. And I'm still thinking, so I do make sacrifices that are not Gandhi-esque, but help me here, Vivian.
So I think this is what I was talking about earlier. When our self-interest and the good that we're doing become so tightly interleaved, it makes it really hard to make clear decisions. Mm. Is this really about the thing that I believe in, the thing I'm willing to make a sacrifice, or is it about me? Have these things become so intrinsically linked that I can't make a clear decision anymore? And in fact, that's where we end up. But actually, that sort of line of thinking gives you some empathy. I routinely poke fun at some fairly powerful people in technology like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, but also, of course, understand what decision would you make if you were looking at the opportunity to become worth $100 billion? And all you had to do was tweet out some highly questionable things that might influence the stock market a tiny bit. It's not your fault that people are fools. you know that if you did this, people that have been mean to you would suffer, and your life will be better. And you believe the thing you're doing. I'm building rocket ships and self-driving electric cars. I am Gandhi, for fuck's sake. Like, this, the world is better because I'm here.
Yes.
I'm Iron Man, he has convinced himself. And Mark Zuckerberg, I mean, they've built a religion on an unregulated social graph. Mm. And no amount of evidence that it is causing harm is going to change their belief in it, because their belief, which has fundamental purpose behind it, is also so deeply wrapped up in the fact that it has turned the entire leadership team into the Uber elite. Once you get to that point, it is incredibly hard. So here's my personal prescription. I am not selling this as anyone's approach to anything in life. Mm-hmm. But for example, I'm never going to listen to this podcast. I never read anything about myself. Mm. I never watch myself on a stage. And the thing, occasionally people don't say nice things. Hell, I went through gender transition. People occasionally say unkind things. But the truth is, almost everyone says wonderful things. I mean, I get it. I know the kind of work that I do. Of course, most people say wonderful things. Mm-hmm. But what if I believe them? What if I believed them, that I'm some wonderful person who's here to save everyone else? That I know for a fact is bullshit. I am just as flawed as anyone is. I am a completely ludicrous character. It's not me. It's my work that's important. And for me, one of the things I am militant about is keeping that dividing line clear. Mm. I've made some very challenging choices in my life to, you know, separate out, for example, my financial interests from the work that Socos Labs does. So quite the opposite. I pay for everything. So I have a financial interest for us not to do new things. So I really have to believe that it's right.
Yeah.
But then I've had good fortune in other parts of my life that allow me to make that choice. So, I am ever vigilant. I don't hide from criticism. Not that that would make you feel bad. It's terrible. But I'm actually so much more afraid of anything someone positive might say about it, because that I know it will all go away. I know that if I ever made that the reason I made my choices, mm-hmm. or I'm going to be even more honest, the dominant reason I made my choices, because it's impossible to completely separate out, as you're saying, even just the ego. I get to be on stages. I get to give a talk to 30,000 people. Mm. You think that's not an ego stroke? When you come off the stage and they say, but where were your slides? And I'm like, oh, I didn't need them. I didn't need slides. That's a crutch, you chump. Of course I have an ego. Mm. That is my enemy. That is the one thing that will take my good life away from me. It is my work that is important. That is what I'm willing to make a sacrifice for. I'm willing to make a sacrifice for my kids, but I've actually really worked hard to realize what my children afford me is actually the opportunity to share their good fortune with as many other kids as I can imagine. My kids already have a great life. As long as I keep up the minimal degree of parenting that I engage in and rely on my wife to do all the hard stuff, they will have some amazing opportunities. Their lives will be better if other kids' lives are better. And so our whole work in education comes out of that. In fact, actually, to tie these things together, I want to know why almost all of my companies have been in education. It's because building courage when you're 50 years old is brutally hard. But putting in place the kinds of experiences that can build it in a five-year-old is vastly easier. You know, what if you could take a parent and just make it easier? You know, my line, be the person you want your kid to be. Have those role modeling effects. What if we made it easier for you to be that person when you needed to be for them? And so building stuff like that has, you know, and again, I said it took me years to get at this. Our first AIs were effectively about getting better grades and test scores. And then I looked at all that research and said, but this doesn't change anything about a kid's life. How do we make education about building a better person instead of a better resume? And that became the focus of all of this work. And yet I still fundamentally see myself as a person demanding ridicule and derision, hopefully with a good heart, but it doesn't take anything away from the work that I do.
Remarkable. Thanks for that answer. I appreciate that. And it's going to give me, I'm going to have to watch this again because I'm going to need to take some of this back out of the guise of having to ask you questions. And the funny thing is that, I mean, even in terms of what I'm doing now is, I pinch myself that here I am chatting to you, somebody I really respect and admire, and I just keep on asking you questions. But I get to do that to try and help other people through this journey. But it's that whole trade-off the whole time. It really, really is. But in terms of your courage, and it's my first thought when you were asked to talk about courage and thinking you've got no research, and I'm thinking, hold on, Vivian, you're it. You're the epitome of courage in terms of some of the things that you've had to do. So I'd like to just end off this chat with two questions that I'd like to ask because I've got very little knowledge of what you've been through and your journey. And the first thing just really fascinates me is, so Evan Smith and no longer exists. And I don't want to know if there was a moment of celebrating the life that was to start this new life with a different identity. And you know, was that a poignant moment or was it just a... How does it even...
You know, you have to understand, the life that was a pretty unhappy life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not begging anyone to feel sorry for me, but if not the least of which is because now I look back on that life and it feels like another person. I mean, this alone is fascinating for, a cognitive neuroscientist. I frequently catch myself remembering high school or junior high with me there, you know, teenage girl. Well, that person never existed.
It existed, yes.
It just, I suddenly realized, no. That day at the lockers at school, there was no sundress. That wasn't me. So, you know, the funny thing is, and I said this to my parents at the time, and I was wrong. I'm just going to be the same person, but happy. And what I thought in some sense, in some graph that I have no idea what the actual axes are, you know, I just time would pass and I get a little bit happier and then I'd level off and I'd be largely the same person, but happy. But the truth is, you just slowly diverge, becoming more and more different. Yeah, maybe the happiness in some sense is not like I'm opioid addled, you know, stuffed with tasty treats all the time. But yeah. What I realize now, the most fascinating part isn't that I was simply wrong, that I'd be a little bit happier, but the same, not just that I diverge, but if I trace it back, it doesn't connect up anymore. You know, in my head, I'm not really that person. Yeah. It's now it feels like I have this long lost brother who is troubled, had a hard time, and who I knew so intimately well. I mean, we were twins. I felt his pain and the loneliness. I'm a total sucker for anything about loneliness. Yeah. It slays me. So, but it really feels now like it was a different person who was lost to mental health, lost on the street. Maybe they're alive, maybe they're dead, but nobody knows. Mm. And a lot of families have stories like that. So, you know, a celebration of that life certainly wasn't what was on my mind. Yeah. In fact, my mother responded, as I think a lot of mothers do, when I came out, you know, I need some time to mourn for that other person. Mm. To which I responded, I'm the same person, but happy. But again, in a sense, she was right and I was wrong. I'm a very different person than I used to be. And I did not appreciate that that would be true. Yeah. So I didn't really have that celebration. Rather, the transition for me, that was a celebration, which is a rare treasure. Even in, you know, the Bay Area, the idea that, but for some admitted bumps along the road, life just continues to get better. Not just happy because I get to be me, but like, wow, and I get to found companies and I get to publish research and all of it gets better and better. You know, that was a real privilege. And, you know, I wish it was that thing. I wish everyone, whatever it is you are changing about yourself, that it gets to be a celebration, that the transition itself, not necessarily a celebration for that person, that's going to be hard work, or the person that you were before, there's a reason you're changing. And you know, understanding the truth of who that person is valuable. It's almost like a truth and reconciliation commission rather than a celebration of the life. You know, let's be honest, but without recrimination. Mm. That's what I went through. But here's the funny thing. Mm-hmm. It was like a grand exercise in improv. And I know that probably sounds like it's completely out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But it was like at one moment I said to the world, scene, you know, I'm now Vivian. I'm a woman. And I said, go. And suddenly people started opening doors for me, which initially I found downright offensive. Whereas by now it's like, this box isn't going to pick itself up. I don't know what all you young men are just standing around doing. But, you know, like overnight, the world said, okay. Which again, what an amazing privilege, because that's what I asked for. Except the downside is like the first day I was me in my own lab was the last day anyone ever asked me a math question. It was just like overnight, oh, you're a woman. That must mean you're a psychologist and not a computational neuroscientist anymore. I do also happen to have a PhD in psychology, but I'm not really that kind of psychologist. I make models of things. But overnight, and when I tried to raise money for my first company, boy, were the VCs happy to give me full credit for being a woman, which means no credit for being a business person.
Yeah.
You know, it was really interesting. And, you know, the funny, it goes deeper than that because the world changed and that actually induced me to change, which then caused the world to change a little bit more and caused me to change. That's why I didn't understand how different I would end up being because that dynamic continued to play out. And again, I know I'm talking about gender transition, which is not going to be part of virtually anyone's story that might ever hear this, but any kind of major life transition is going to be like that, where you feel like you have to make it all at once. But sorry, I'm a nerd. It's a dynamical process and you're going to change and the world's going to change and there will be a back and forth. You need a little pressure. You need engagement to get the world to keep moving for you. But once it does, it becomes a tide and you can really move along with that and slowly move out to be that person you want to be. Another domain where it takes effort and it takes time. It can be really hard at moments. again, not just transition, but yes, it turns out that there are some challenging parts to that. There's really only two advantages I've ever seen that men have. One is peeing standing up, which I will freely acknowledge is a useful superpower.
Yeah.
You know, when the whole world is your toilet.
Yeah.
But turns out it's not as useful like in everyday business.
Yeah.
And the other is just being taken seriously for the things you can do. And there's a value in coming to terms with the world suddenly seeing you different, but in, you know, a more diminished form. As you realize at the same time, how much of who you were was a fiction already? How much was in their heads rather than in you? Either they overvalued me before, in which case I'm being appropriately valued now, or they were getting it right before and now I'm being unjustifiably maligned. The only thing is you understand how malleable all of this stuff is and how much control you could actually have in changing it. Just understand it's more than just you. You're changing the whole world because it needs to make that space for you. And it's hard and it takes time.
And didn't you at any stage want to jump up in a boardroom and say, hey, you bunch of men, I was one of you. What the actual? I would want to do that. I'd wonder, what the hell is wrong with you people?
It is, you know, there are some times. I remember once, this was just a few years ago. Let me say, there's only one thing that truly, genuinely bothers me, and that is mansplaining. All of the rest of it, I can run with. Now, you know, obviously, I don't live a life where I'm on the street or I'm a sex worker and all the brutalism that happens about that. I live a totally different life than that. So, yes, the part that comes up with me is how often I had an actual conversation. I gave a keynote at this big event in South Africa once, and I got off the stage, and some guy walked up to me and said, I didn't hear your talk, but here's what was wrong with it. Note again, I was talking about my own scientific research, of which he is not even a scientist. And he didn't hear the talk.
And he didn't,
But through his own mouth. The fact that, and it is invariably a middle-aged guy. I've never had that from a woman. I've never had it from a younger guy, but I think it's because I'm a little scary. The idea that you just walk up to an expert and tell them why I have this vague impression that you're wrong is astonishing. And I learned this trick, which obviously it came relatively late in my life, which is write about it. I am just finishing a piece of writing right now called This Is Not the Industrial Revolution. And it was literally, I had been on a panel at a Milken Institute conference with this guy who was the most aggravating person I've ever shared a stage with in my entire life. And it was so frustrating. Just the hand waviness of, oh, this is known. Like the way he'd cite a fact, which was not a fact. It was untrue. It was like debating Trump. and he would say these things. And I could have let it eat at me and eat at me. Or I could have shouted at him, but instead I took a different kind of power from it, which is I got off the stage that evening as it was still going through my head. I wrote down, this is not underlined, the Industrial Revolution. And that is now turned into like a 50,000 word essay that will be a chapter in an upcoming book because that just turned in such a rich space. What would my response to him be? I have all of this research that I know he doesn't have because that isn't his job.
Yeah.
What is it, if I give him respect, what is it that he's not understanding about this problem? And we write it all out. My one acknowledgement is that every subsection in this very long chapter, a 50,000 word chapter.
Oh, because that's a book by itself.
I know. We'll see how it all gets edited down. But everyone starts off with a quote from Pompous Mansplainer. So every subsection of this chapter is a direct response to things he and others have said on stage or paraphrasings of them. Yeah. And it was just, you know, it became a way that I found, you know, when I was me before, my instinct would be punch this.
Yeah. But that's what happens. You punch and he punches and you punch and he, and then an eye for an eye makes the world blinder, right?
And I'm incredibly, you know, well, but that person was really unhappy and always ready for a fight.
Yeah.
Why would I want, that's the very person that I have abandoned? Why would I want to still be that? Yes, it was frustrating, but I found actually a much better way of dealing with those frustrations. Doesn't mean I let people walk all over me in the moment. Absolutely not. Mm. But I don't pick a fight. I find it's a lot more valuable to me to actually something, interestingly enough, I didn't learn as a woman, I learned as an entrepreneur, which is if I pitched a startup to a venture capitalist and they didn't get it, mm-hmm. you know, like, and I was there, like some co-founders would be leaving a pitch and they'd be like, that guy was an idiot. He didn't understand anything about what we were doing. And I reflected on hearing them say that and my own feelings. And I would think, but what's the one thing I can actually take control of?
Yeah.
And the only thing I can take control of is why did I not do the homework to know that I shouldn't have pitched this guy in the first place? Surely I could have seen that they wouldn't have understood this. And that was my first time out. So it was like, anyone that's willing to give us, you know, 15 minutes in a room, absolutely, let's go pitch.
We'll take it,
and I've learned since, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Find the, I mean, particularly because all of my work is very technical and complicated, absolutely find someone that's going to get the whole spectrum of what you're doing. Pitch them. They're going to actually run with it. Take real ownership and control of the things that you have control over. What good does it do you? So the guy on stage with me was a jerk. You know, the two things I could have done was choose not to go on stage. I've never made that choice before, and I don't think I ever will. And that wasn't even the worst time. Or get up there and in the moment, be as honest as I can without engaging in, you know, his bombacity, and then take that opportunity to learn from it. What was he saying? Why might it appeal to someone? And why do I have such a different understanding of that problem? And then write it down and publish a book, because that's what everyone does, right?
That's exactly right. And I think it's a very good way for us to end off this conversation is that, so my whole journey, and I guess it's with everything we discussed in this conversation, is about focusing on the things that you can control and working hard at trying to improve at those things. And a lot of people ask me how on earth I got to the other end of three different brain cancers. And for me, it was exactly that. It was that moment I discovered that there was absolutely no point in fighting against something I couldn't control, fighting against something I couldn't even see, fighting against something that wasn't going to have no impact, and focusing rather on things that I can control. And then the other thing that you said, which I found fascinating, is the idea of a neuroscientist understanding these two different identities. And essentially, I'm going with this is the stories we tell ourselves, right? And how good we can become at believing those stories to this young teenage girl in a sundress at outside a locker. You know, that is a story we tell ourselves, and how powerful those are. And again, there's the feeling in the thinking brain, and is it not rational? And then what it means to you. And that to me is this whole juggle of this amazing journey called life, and figuring out what's meaning and purpose and happiness and all of that. And I'd so value this time together. And thank you so much for your input and your impact. And I know it's going to make a very, very big difference in a lot of people's lives. So I'm indebted to you, and thank you so much.
It was an absolute pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
For me too. Thank you. And I really hope we do it again sometime. In fact, I'd love to do it over a cup of coffee at some point in time. That'd be amazing. Who knows what the future brings.
Someday I'll come out to your neck of the woods.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Cheers.
Bye.
Thank you for staying right to the end of the episode and for joining me on the Enrichment Project. Before you go, please share this episode with your friends and your colleagues. They will thank you, I'm sure. Remember that you can catch each Path to Purpose episode by watching on YouTube, or if you prefer, on your favorite podcast app. The link to my book, The Power of Purpose, is in the show notes. Please go and check it out. It's a rad account of my own story of purpose and resilience and my fight against brain cancer. I finished 6 full Ironman events, a number of multi-stage mountain bike races, 9 Ironman 70.3 races, including the Ironman World Championships, and a bunch of other endurance events, all with stage 4 brain cancer, because I wanted it that badly, and getting to the finish line meant that much to me.
As a professional inspirational speaker, business and life coach, author and storyteller, I'd love to add more value to you or your organization. Please find more details on my website, iamrichardwright.com, and book me today for a live or virtual keynote, a masterclass, workshop, or coaching session, or please follow my journey on Facebook, I Am Richard Wright, Twitter, The Wright Rich, Instagram, I Am Richard Wright, or on LinkedIn. I'd love the opportunity to enrich your team. Thank you to the professional crew at Solid Gold Podcasts for the support, the talent, and the mad skills. And to Anna Hick for her creativity and genius video magic. Thank you. You all rock.